future. There are no people. There are no people in the future. No people at all. There are no people in the future. Where did all my people go? There are no people in the future. Let me try my people call.
Welcome. It is Monday, September 6th, 2021. Well, actually, kind of not really. It's like we're actually pre-recording this this version here. We're going to do a live version a little bit later on. But let's pretend, everybody, it is Labor Day. Yes, welcome to a special Labor Day episode of Raging Chicken's Out to Coop Live. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. On Out to Coop Live, we talk to progressives, activists, and troublemakers of all sorts, right from our own backyards, from across the country. On Fridays, of course, Sean Kitchen and I break down the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. And on Wednesday, next week, Cyril is back. Yes, the Wednesday show with Cyril Michaleko. Cyril's a progressive columnist for the Bucks County Courier-Times, the Intelligencer. And he joins me to drill down into Bucks County, Pennsylvania, and international politics. You can get all our shows by subscribing to our podcast on Podbean, iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. You can support this show by becoming a patron for as little as $5 a month. Just head on over to patreon.com/rcpress. And if you're listening to this show on the Podbean app by any chance, well, you can show us some love right now by hitting that big green patron button at the top of the page, too. You can also help out the show by going on over to our YouTube channel if you're not there already and smash that subscribe button and like the stream for this show and hit that notification bell so you know every time that we go live. And as I said, we're pre-recording today's show, so we're not going to be taking any live calls on this particular segment, but we will have a special live show at 7 p.m. on Monday, which we're going to follow up on some of the issues here and look a little bit into this Labor Day. You can join our Discord server. You can check out the show notes for how to join that. And if you're looking for more PA progressive talk, you can tune into the Rick Smith Show's live stream at 9 p.m. Eastern or on his YouTube channel, Twitter, you know, wherever you get your streams. And you want all his information about his shows on WBAI, about on Free Speech TV, just hit the ricksmithshow.com for all the latest for across all his platforms. And you absolutely have to check out the Sisters of the Night Caucus podcast. Yes, the amazing PA women stirring the political cauldron behind this podcast rock the house. And they know where the bodies are buried. Spooky, right? Yep, make sure to follow them on Twitter at the Night Caucus. That's at the Night Caucus on Twitter. And subscribe to their podcast on Anchor, Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. And once, got to give a shout out to, for all those gamers out there. Yes, the Game Inn. That's with two N's. The Game Inn is a Quakertown-based black family-owned gaming store. They're friends of the show, and they've got everything from retro N64s, the latest consoles, video games, and all platforms, collectibles, action figures, Funko Pops, you name it. And kids, yeah, back to school. Yep, even in this kind of pandemic situation. Well, if they get an A on their report card, they head on over there and they get a discount on their purchases. Check them out on Twitter at The Game Inn. That's at The Game Inn with two N's. And if you got a question about a game, looking for something that's hard to find, shoot them an email at thegameinnpa@gmail.com. And the special shout out always goes to Jonathan Mann, who wrote our intro song, There Are No People in the Future. Check out all his great stuff on his YouTube page and follow him on Twitter at SongADayMan. Again, two N's, at SongADayMan on Twitter. So here we are today. This is a special Labor Day kind of edition of Out to Coop Live. And as promised, we have a special guest today, right? And our guest is Steve Oros. Steve Oros is a professor of psychology at Kutztown University. And as you recall, on our show from last Wednesday, gave you a little background about Steve's case. And we're going to get into his story. Steve is basically, he had a heart transplant earlier this year. And his doctors have said he's not been allowed to go back to work in person because of the risks of the pandemic and contracting COVID-19. And when he wanted to kind of look for appropriate accommodations for that, and he approached this early on to the university, what did they say? They said, no, you got to choose between your life and your livelihood. And so that's why we're bringing Steve on today, because Steve, and he'll tell you this even better than I can possibly tell you, he is not alone in this. This is happening to faculty members at Kutztown University. It's happening to employees and workers across the country. They're being forced back to work into this, in this kind of bizarre anti-human austerity that is going on right now after this pandemic. So without further ado, Steve, man, I appreciate you so much for coming on the show.
Kevin, I'm really the one who should be appreciative. I'm having a chance to tell the story of me and others, and that's all I can do right now.
Well, look, I think that, you know, the history, and, you know, you've probably heard me say this at some point or another, is, you know, look, any time that change has occurred, the stories of people, and people are willing to come forward and tell their stories like you, is that the kind of thing that can actually move stuff, especially when every other system that is supposed to be responding is not doing it. So, but look, so before we get into the specifics of kind of like the back to school and what happened at Kutztown, just so everybody kind of hears it from you, kind of a little bit, take us through a little bit about your kind of medical journey. That's kind of, that was the, I don't know, the prelude to what brings us to where we are today.
Okay. Let me start by going back actually to 2014. Mm-hmm. In, let's say, June 2014, and prior to that, I had some health concerns, but I was active, healthy. I was a Boy Scout leader. I took scouts on trips on the Appalachian Mountain trails, camped out, did all that. In June and into the early part of July of 2014, I took my family on a cross-country tour of colleges. My son was considering where to go. We hopped in the car, made a vacation of it, drove Tennessee, Texas, Missouri, all over.
That sounds amazing.
It was. We drove through a tornado. my kids were tracking they were tracking where the tornado was and where we were. And I kept saying, "No, we'll be okay. We'll be okay." So we did all that, and we got back to Pennsylvania. I forget the exact day, but it was shortly after July 4th. And a couple days after, I woke up in the morning feeling hot and clammy. No other symptoms, but just felt really hot. Not sure what's going on. I asked my wife. She got me an aspirin. I chewed it up, just thinking there are varying possibilities.
Right, sure.
Sat for a little while, wasn't feeling any better, hopped in a cold shower just to see if that would start making me feel better. Got out of the shower and immediately started sweating again. And I said, yeah, to myself, something's wrong here.
Yeah.
So I threw on my clothes. I forgot about the shoes. I just threw on some clothes and I ran out to the car yelling to my wife, "We got to go." Now, I didn't call an ambulance because it takes an ambulance the same amount of time to get to my house than it takes us to get to the hospital. Mm-hmm. So she jumped in the car, kept saying, "Should we call an ambulance?" And I'm saying, "Just drive. Just drive." And the whole way there, "Should we pull over and call an ambulance?" "Just drive. Just drive." And we went to St. Joseph's Hospital, which is now part of the Penn State Health Yep. Network. I remember pulling up to the emergency room. In my mind, I can still see the emergency signs. My wife ran in to the hospital. I stayed in the car. In my memory, I stepped out of the car and then fell. But it turns out that memory's false. I never got out of the car until people got me out of the car. I was rushed in, and after obviously the initial assessments, it turned out I was experiencing what's known as a widowmaker heart attack.
Oh my God, I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
So this heart attack, according to the American Heart Association, has a survival rate of 12%.
Yep.
I survived. I had, in the hospital, I had a double bypass, and I don't remember this at all, and I'll explain why I don't remember any of this time in the hospital in just a moment. But I was recovering. I was up walking. One day before I was to be released, I reported that my right leg was sore. They decided it was a blood clot, and they gave me a typical medicine named heparin to treat the clot. Mm-hmm. It's commonly used to coat surgical instruments. Yep. It's commonly used in the medical setting. Turns out I have a very rare immune system mediated allergy to heparin. There's no screening test for it. So they gave me this dose of heparin, and instead of dissolving the clot, it caused my platelet levels to drop dramatically and eventually started causing extreme clotting in my body. I was airlifted to Hershey Hospital because they have the means to help with that. Apparently it was touch and go. I know by report, not by memory, that I was shocked several times to reset the heart. I was flown up to Hershey in a helicopter. I like to joke that it was my one and only helicopter ride, but I don't remember it. My son says, I don't want to remember. But at Hershey, apparently, besides being shocked, my heart must have stopped at one point. I was resuscitated by a nurse who I later met, which is kind of cool. Mm-hmm. And I was put on ECMO. It's essentially a heart-lung machine. Mm-hmm. The blood is taken out of my body, run through to oxygenate it and warm it up, and then it's pumped back into my body. And it's a means of letting the lungs and heart rest. So I was on ECMO and in a medically induced coma. And at some point, I started waking up.
How long of a period of time are we talking about there?
By now, we're talking probably a two-week period at that point.
2 weeks.
But including the St. Joseph's time and when I start to come out of the heart lung. They ask me, do I know where I am? As you know, part of, are you oriented? Do you know what's happened to you? And I said, I'm at Hershey Hospital. And my memory is they were all astonished that I remember that. But wow. I'm laying there, frankly, at that point, and I'm thinking, I just read it off your lab coats. I didn't know where I was. They asked me,
wait, this is not the helicopter. So. Right.
I didn't know about the helicopter. Oh, they then asked me what year it was, and I said something like 1870 or so. No, I wasn't coherent at the moment, not fully. They started countering the effects of the heparin. I stayed there, at least another week, and first up at the heart and vascular intensive care unit, and then in intensive care itself, before I was transferred. Well, I'll get into this first, but then I was transferred to Reading Rehabilitation Hospital. Back at Hershey, there was a question, where do I go? Because when I woke up, I was extremely weak. I could raise my arm laying in the bed, but it was effort just to raise my arm. I could not sit up. I could not move my legs or feet at all. I don't know at that moment if I'm paralyzed or not.
Right.
There was discussion in that time period about whether or not at least one of my legs would have to be amputated. They ended up not amputating the leg, but I do have nerve damage in the legs from that clotting. So I'll come back to this after the Reading rehab. But so one of the questions was, do I go to nursing care? Is there no hope for recovery, or do I go to a rehab hospital? And my wife fought, and I did everything I could to get to a rehab hospital. I did not want to go into nursing care. Mm-hmm. One way they were going to make the decision, not the only way, but one way, was if I could show any signs of moving my legs. And in my memory, they came in and saw me on a Thursday, and I couldn't move anything. And they said they were going to come back on Friday and see if there was any progress. And if not, they were going to recommend nursing care. I might have the days off a little bit.
Sure, sure, sure.
That's my memory. Turns out they didn't come in Friday. Good thing, because I could not move my legs Friday. On the weekend, nobody comes by other than the critical staff, but the physical therapists don't. And I spent Friday, Saturday, and Sunday trying to move my toes or my leg in some way. And I teach physiological psychology. I have long taught about a case of a gentleman by the name of Ian Waterman, who had a mysterious virus that caused him to be unable to feel his body. And he retaught himself how to move. So I spent the weekend thinking of Ian.
Wow.
And I said, if Ian can do this, maybe I can. And by Monday, I was able to slightly lift my left leg and slightly curl the toes on my left foot. And that was enough to get them to send me to a rehab hospital instead of nursing care. I was fortunate to be able to go to the Reading Rehab, which is closer to my family. And I spent a long time there. The total time from St. Joseph's to Hershey to the Reading Rehab Hospital. And while at rehab, I was shuttled periodically back and forth to the Reading Hospital. So four hospitals. Mm-hmm. That total time was July, August, September, October. Wow. And I came home in October and almost immediately took a long car ride to Ohio where my wife's mother was dying. And that's why we were fighting to get released in October so that we could go to her funeral. Tough trip,
wow.
Both emotionally and physically.
Yeah.
I spent a year in a wheelchair on medical leave. I came back to work and took another year in a wheelchair. So when I came back, my office is on the third floor of Old Main, elevator up, elevator down to classrooms. That's what I had to do. After roughly 2 years, I was able to start transitioning to a walker. I spent, again, roughly 2 years using a walker before I was stable enough to start using a cane. And I've been using a cane really ever since. Now, my heart was damaged. One measure, there are a number of measures, but one is called an ejection fraction. What percentage of the blood that enters your heart is ejected with each heartbeat? Should be up in the 50-55% range. Mine was at 20. And it stayed at that for 6 years.
I would assume that if, you know, at that percentage level, right, you still are feeling the effects of this, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes. I mean, this is not like, okay, yeah, that's just a number, but you're fairly, you know, recovered. In addition to, you know, what you're talking about, the damage to your leg, you're also, I would imagine you get tired out more quickly and everything as we go along with this.
You're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. Tired, the nerve damage, the frustration, the, you know, self-pity, to be honest. I got somewhat depressed during that period of time. And I was in chronic pain for years.
Well, let me just say this too as well. I mean, just for a little bit of context. I mean, you know, like, you know, what I said on the program last week too as well is like, you know, I mean, I've known you for a long time. I mean, we've worked together at Kutztown University for quite some time. Yes. And I totally get where that would be extraordinarily frustrating for you, because I mean, if the one thing that I've known about you as long as I've known you, right, is that you are active, you are kind of like constantly on the move, that you are determined, right? And you know, and I said this on the show, I said this to you beforehand too as well, and like, you know, dealing especially even like faculty members like me who are not always the easiest ones to work with, right? Mm-hmm. Is that you always did, you know, this work with, say, persistence and determination and kindness all throughout that. And I've always have kind of admired the kind of like energy and drive that you have had over the years. And so, to be in that context and coming back, and my guess would be, you know, from what I know of you, to be like your mind wants to be back in that place, but your body is not getting you there.
Absolutely. Totally get it. And that bothered me. It took me a long time to work through that. And I still struggle with it sometimes.
Yeah.
But I did. I came back. I worked. I did the housework. Not as efficiently as I would have liked, but I did it.
Yeah. So
that's the context. I'm just hovering at this 20% or so ejection fraction. I think 25% on occasion, but right in that range. So the summer of 2020 now, I'm scheduled to run the fall semester, and I'm starting to feel more tired. Mm-hmm. But I'm on the books. I'm going to run fall 2020 courses. And with apologies to everybody, faculty, students, advisees, that was my worst semester ever. I struggled.
Yeah.
I didn't know it at the time, but my ejection fraction was dropping. And I had had an implanted, not just pacemaker, but a defibrillator implanted. So they've thread wires through the veins and arteries into my heart so that if the rhythm is different enough, it'll shock my heart back into function. Same function as these external defibrillators we know of. Hadn't had a shock in all those years. So in the fall 2020, I start getting shocked. Now, I don't know I'm being shocked. I was always told you would feel it. It would be like a donkey kicking or a horse kicking you in the chest. I never felt that.
Wow.
What I did feel is I went unconscious. I would fall. It would shock me. I would hit the ground. So I hit my head. I hit my eye. You know, got bruises and cuts from falling at times. But I'm trying to get through the semester.
Yeah.
And so I'm having some changes in my medicines. I'm having some minor surgical procedures to do whatever I can to get through the semester. But I did some things poorly. I did some okay, but I did some things poorly.
Well, I mean, not that I'm like the guide on this one, but I mean, you know, I hope you're kind to yourself about that because look,
not yet.
Well, seriously, you know, I say this to my students all the time. I'm like, look, you know, that are going through really some tough things. Just remember, this is one small slice out of a big arc of time.
Yeah.
Right. And then we all get to like not work up to our potential. We all get to make mistakes and we all get to be kind to ourselves and know that we can move on. Cause like I said, Steve, I mean, I know few people have worked as hard as you at what you do. So.
Well, I try to say that to other people as well, but it's hard. Yes, myself.
I get it 100%.
Yeah. So, as I was being shocked in several times, I decide that I know it had to be the heart. And so I go back to my cardiologist and said, I want to be reevaluated to see if I'm eligible for a heart transplant. And the reason I ask that is I had previously been told, no, I would not be a candidate. Mm-hmm. They had started talking to me about a mechanical pump, a left ventricular assistive device. It's a pump that helps the heart move blood throughout your body, but it's powered by external batteries. So a power cord comes off this pump, exits through your belly. You're either plugged into a wall or these portable batteries.
Right.
And you're not allowed to go in water. You can't take a shower. You know, I didn't want it, at least at that time. And frankly, still didn't. But I thought I'd go as long as I could and see what happened.
Right.
But when this started, I said, I got to get reevaluated. And they agreed to reevaluate me. So I started going in for testing in January of 2021. Spent a little over a week, or well, besides day trips, I spent over a week in the hospital while they did testing. I made them release me because my daughter was going to study abroad and I wanted to see her off. Mm-hmm. They wanted me to stay, but I wanted to see her off. And then I came back in February after going to see her. When I came in for what I thought was going to be another day visit, they told me, no, you're not going home. You have three choices. You get a transplant, you get a left ventricular assistive device, or you go into hospice care. That's it. So they keep evaluating and it's touch and go. I'm not touch and go in terms of surviving, although the ejection fraction is at the point where you could die. I'm at 10% by this point. But it's touch and go whether I'll get approval. In fact, the evening before they finally approved me, the surgeon said, I don't really think we can do a transplant on you. Oh, and then the next morning he comes in and says, no, we're going to go ahead and try. So, you know, I spent that evening, of course, you know, at this point,
yeah,
thinking I have to do the pump or not. You know,
right. No. Yeah.
So the next morning he comes in, tells me, I go on the national transplant list and I'm really fortunate. One day after going on the list, they come in and tell me they might have a heart. Turns out, no, the heart wasn't acceptable. So you have that little, oh boy, I'm going to get one.
Yep.
No, I'm not. Mm-hmm. But I didn't have to wait much longer. I think it was 4 days after they came in and said, we really think we have one. We can't promise it. We're going right to look at it. But our plan is you're getting a heart tonight.
Wow.
So they start doing all the prep on my end at the same time that doctors from Hershey, gotta praise them. For the dedication and effort, everybody there, housekeeping, nursing staff, everybody was outstanding. They surgeons or some of the doctors fly to get the heart. Mine was located somewhere near Boston. My wife tracked the plane while they went. I got wheeled up to this operating room. And fortunately, the heart that they were looking, not fortunately for me, not for the donor, obviously.
Sure.
And I have a bracelet with a green ribbon on it in recognition of organ donors. I was always an organ donor.
Ditto, yeah.
But now I benefited from it. Mm-hmm. I went up on February 24th for the surgery. I came down the morning of the 25th. And I recovered well. There's all sorts of testing, including threading a little pincher device, a biotome, in through the veins of my heart, into the heart and into the interior of the heart, and cutting tissue samples. Yeah. And then examining the tissue for changes that are indications of organ rejection. So they're doing all sorts of testing. And my tests come back pretty good. We're really fortunate. And I still go up for repeated testing. It's starting to get spread out in time, but this actually right now I finally moved to every 2 months that I have to go up. I have to have blood tests in between, mm-hmm. but every 2 months.
So at this point, how long are they projecting that this is going to take in terms of recovery, rehabilitation?
Yeah.
What's that prognosis at that point?
Sure. A couple levels of it. First, mm-hmm. I'm told I'll probably be in the hospital for another month mm-hmm. To recover. And before being able to go home and start entering some physical rehabilitation processes. it's unclear because it depends how well my body accepts the heart.
Right, right, obviously.
How long it would take before I might move on, for instance, to come back to work. But the most, maybe not the most conservative, but a reasonable estimate they were saying is maybe a year. Mm-hmm. But I turned out to be doing so well that I was actually released from the hospital in 1 week and one day.
It's like, I can imagine everybody looking around at each other like, look at this.
Did you yes. And to be honest, they're saying that to me. And I'm thinking they're just being nice.
Right.
And maybe they were, but that's apparently uncommon. So I come back. I can't really do anything. I'm drained. I can't go up the stairs. I'm sleeping downstairs in a reclining chair. I can't even get up, frankly, to go get my own drinks. I can barely get to a toilet on my own. But I, people take care of me at home. I start getting stronger, and I eventually get home physical care. And I got a shout out to Thomas from NovaCare. It was hard to find somebody in a pandemic who would come to my house where I live. And Thomas stepped up to do this. And that, to be honest, was luck. I found out about Thomas because he's the son-in-law of my neighbor.
Wow.
And my neighbor contacted Thomas, who contacted me. And then Thomas had to go through an approval process with the Hershey Hospital, and they approved him, and then he came in. Otherwise, people were saying, no, we don't have the staff to come help you. And Thomas worked with me to the point where I could finally be approved to go to get additional rehab. And I went through it's a 36-visit cardiac rehab program. And I went to Lehigh Valley Hospital for that. So now I'm at my fifth hospital.
Exactly. Did they give you patches or something? So that you
what I do have is pillows. I have two heart-shaped pillows that are signed by some of the nursing staff. But I do have that.
It's like a mission patch. I think you deserve a mission patch for each one of the hospitals that you went through. Seriously. Right.
And again, they were wonderful. So I went in, I was evaluated for the rehab program in late April, and I was in rehab April, May, June, July, and August.
That brings me up to this August, right?
This August. And that's the point where I'm told I'm still meeting with the doctors in Hershey.
Right.
But it's in July and August, based on the test results I'm getting, the medical test results, and the reporting from the rehab, that they say, you know what? Yeah, we think you might be able to go to work this fall, six months.
So let's now let me just, because this is where, you know, we're moving from a story. Right. As you said, some of this stuff was luck. And it's astounding to me, one, that we live in a society that so much of this is based, ends up on luck if we can get things done.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's remarkable to begin with. But at the same time, it's a story of every level of care that you've had at this point was all these folks that are super competent, working with you, doing all this stuff to make sure to get you better. Right. And that's the story that kind of comes up to before you decided to go back to work. Now, it would be, correct me if I'm wrong, it would not be out of the ordinary for somebody to say, okay, look, I'm not going back to work in the fall, right? We're going to take the full year of recovery, right, in order to do this. But you wanted to get back to work.
Absolutely. It wasn't my primary goal. Mm-hmm. My primary goal was the family.
Yeah, totally.
But it was one of the next major goals. I wanted to come back to work as soon as possible. In my mind, I had to redeem myself for my poor semester. And I wanted to come back. So at once they say, okay, they say, bud, you can't go on campus. Mm-hmm. COVID is running. We're still in a pandemic. You know, I'm not apologizing to people who think their pandemic's over. You're wrong. The pandemic is still running.
Yeah.
And perhaps becoming worse.
Well, I could look, my wife is a physician, right? And she sees this all the time. And she's just like, people, what they're doing and how people are acting is not what's actually happening on the ground.
No.
And it is not at all.
No. And it's affecting not only the healthcare workers. During this time for the transplant, I'm only allowed one visitor. And it's the same person because of COVID predict. So my family, other than my wife, cannot come see me. That's the reality.
Right.
And these professionals are caring for people, including people who have COVID. Mm-hmm. There were individuals on my floor who had been diagnosed with COVID. Mm-hmm. It's impressive what the healthcare professionals have put up with.
Yeah, it's amazing. And so we've got, so we're sitting here, you're getting say, well, look, we might be able to go back. There's no way you're going on campus because, you know, my understanding is from talking to you kind of ahead of today too, is that as part of the treatment of kind of getting better, you need to make sure that the heart takes, right?
Yes.
So that you're on medications, right? That suppress, right? This kind of like, the rejection response, the immune response, we've got to try to say, you know, no, that's just part of what organ transplant you do. So you are, not only is it that you can't go back because, okay, we're concerned about, but it legitimately, like if you were to get COVID, that could be it, right?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. That's what they're telling me.
Right.
I cannot. I am immune suppressed. I will be immune suppressed the rest of my life. But the amount of immune suppressing drugs that I need to take gets reduced over time. So my risk of being infected lessens with time, but it's still a risk.
So we've
and
got,
particularly the first year,
particularly
for the first year.
Absolutely. And so here we are, right? And now we just out now kind of to move away from Steve's story just for a second. We remember that, like, because of COVID and the pandemic, I'm not telling anybody that things that they don't know already, but at Kutztown University, like college universities across the country, right, we had to make a switch on the dime change in the way that we kind of educated folks, right? The way that we taught, the way that we did stuff because of the pandemic. And faculty just did amazing stuff, right? Just to try to get through, first of all, the end of 2020, the end of that semester, the spring 2020, right? And then shifted everything online, right? In many cases, I was fortunate enough to kind of be fairly technologically savvy, but a lot of like faculty who just don't do this kind of stuff, right? Aren't familiar with all the, they did it, right? And we found new ways, we learned new things, we stepped up so that we could make sure that we could deliver education. And all through that process, we were told by our administration, we were told by the state system of higher education, by the chancellor, that we needed to look for new innovative and flexible ways to kind of address education. We need to kind of like, understand that, education can't just be just one thing, that we need to be creative and open-minded for how we did it. So we did that. Right. And so, and not only that, we build skill sets, right? Not just as faculty members, but the IT departments, right? The help desks, right? And students were learning that too as well. So that we knew that not only did we just do that for a year, but we were building a capacity that if anything like that were to happen again, we've got that flexibility built into what we're doing. Right. I mean, that was all of our understanding as what we're doing as faculty members, like for the most part. Yes, the vast majority of us wanted to get back into the classroom. I know you wanted to get back in the classroom.
Yes.
Right.
Absolutely.
So there's no question about that, because I mean, if you ask me, do I like online teaching? I'm going to say, hell no. Right. Mm-hmm. I said, but right. If I'm going to sit there and how do we do this? Am I going to step up and try to make it work and try to do it? Absolutely. So we already have that. We've been told that this is what we're doing. We're moving to these new modalities of education and so on. We hit August, your doctors come along and they say, Steve, look, it looks like, if you're up to it, we think that we can clear you to go back to work, but there's no way you can go back on campus. right? So now you're in the position now, you say, okay, now I need to take that information and I need to go to the appropriate people at Kutztown University and have a conversation, right?
Yeah, yes. So, you know, the courses that I was to have taught have been in the schedule since November of 2020, I guess. Mm-hmm. Finalized in the catalog somewhere in January 2021, maybe very early February. They're put in the catalog as face-to-face courses. That's my goal. That's the goal of the university. And if we need, we do as we had to. We adapt and innovate and come back in a remote format. If I can't come back, the university has to find somebody to replace me. They have the classrooms reserved. They're face-to-face courses. Now, I go to the university. I'm thinking this is great news. I can come back, but I just can't do it
right
in person. I first approach human resources informally and just say, you know, I'm not able to come back. I want to, that's my goal, but I'm not going to be cleared for that. So I want to formally request an accommodation to allow me to conduct my courses through the online format. The first request, no. No mechanism for us to do that. There is a mechanism by which you can apply to do that through the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act. And they direct me to where and how to do the paperwork. But in that same note, they tell me, but I'm telling you now, if you do that, we're going to reject your accommodation request. They've not even seen the documentation yet. I haven't even applied yet. And they're telling me we're going to deny this. It's a blanket denial.
Yes.
And this is not just me. Others are getting the same response. I know of people who are, for varying reasons, are not able to come forward who have gotten that same blanket denial.
Let me just read. This is from Kutztown University's HR department, right? So this is, I want to read from you this email that you shared with faculty so they can see what's going on too as well.
Yeah.
And say, you could apply for an ADA accommodation, but under the ADA, an accommodation is not considered reasonable if it is a fundamental alteration so significant that it changes the essential nature of the goods, services, facilities, privileges, advantages, or accommodations offered. Changing the modality of a course from in-person to online would be considered a fundamental alteration. This is before you even speak to anybody about ADA accommodation. They're telling you, we're already considering this a fundamental alteration. So,
yes.
Good luck.
Yes. Absolutely. And I want to say this. I can declare that an orange has the color purple. That declaration doesn't mean it's true. Right. So you want to declare that changing the format is a fundamental alteration? Yeah, I'm not so convinced that that's true. I've already been researching this. There are others researching this on my behalf. There are other universities who have stated that it is not a fundamental alteration. There are other professional organizations who have said requesting that change is not a fundamental alteration. Kutztown tells me it is.
Especially, so this is why I said this stuff about what we had just done over the past year, because what had happened, it wasn't just everybody was teaching kind of like, you know, these, you know, at your own pace courses. We were doing in-person, like synchronous education in the same time slots as a normal class was going to be taught, right? As a way of keeping that kind of modality consistent within the terms of the semester.
So, yes.
And they have technology even in the classrooms, right? And to able to ensure that if you need to go from a classroom space to an online space, given, oh, I don't know, a pandemic, right? That would be possible, right?
Yes.
And so let's be clear about that. We're not talking about going to online and just like, you know, a student like doing like a correspondence course where they're just kind of like, you know, like filling out random things online for some robot instructor. We're talking about delivering it through the kind of that mediated means. And they're saying that, nope, even though we just did that and we considered it the same thing for kind of the year, no, we're not anymore. We're going to pretend the pandemic is over and now we're back to as they've been saying, pre-pandemic times.
Yes. And my, you know, as I'm doing these requests through HR, I'm talking to the department chair and saying, how are we going to do this? And we are talking exactly what you described. We're talking synchronous, online. Students can come to the same classroom they were going to. I would be remote. I could see them. They could see me. We would cover exactly the same material and satisfy each of the learning objectives of the course. None of the fundamental characteristics of the course, other than me being remote, are changing.
Right.
They're getting the same material, same learning objectives. I'm sharing videos. I'm sharing slides. We're talking. They're doing viewing of other films and reading original research and summaries of research and looking at real world applications of the concepts. Everything I would do in person, I'm doing or would do in the online format. So I filed the ADA. Big surprise, I'm denied. You know, I don't get the official paperwork. And I think it was the 18th of April at that point.
August, you mean, right?
Of August, excuse me. Yes, August. Yep, my mistake. Sorry.
Okay. That's right.
So I'm now saying, well, what the hell do I do? They're not letting me in. I only have 15 days of sick leave left because I used sick leave for the surgery. I can only, by contract, use 90 sick days in a year. I've used 75 for the spring semester. I've got 15 sick days remaining and two personal days, a little over 3 weeks. And they tell me, here's your alternative. You can go on unpaid leave for the remainder of the time. No other accommodation, no discussion, no willingness to sit down. So at that time, I say, I hear from others about a sabbatical possibility. Mm-hmm. A sabbatical for the restoration of health. And I say, well, I can do that for a semester and I'll ramp up the rehabilitation efforts so that I can get approved to come in person, mm-hmm. not just remote. Nope, I'm denied. With the reasoning being, my doctors already cleared me to teach.
My God.
They cleared me to teach remotely. They didn't clear me to come back in person. I'm saying I'm going to rehab so I can come back in person. And they say, no, can't do that.
Now, look, at this point, if this was me, I would be reading what they're doing is they're giving me an ultimatum. Is they're basically threatening, say, if you don't get back in, if you don't get back into the classroom, then we're not helping you. Good luck to you.
You're not the only one reading it that way. I wrote that in my letter to HR. I said a lot of things. I didn't swear, but I said, this is not a interactive discussion about accommodations. It's an ultimatum.
Right.
They came back when they denied the sabbatical. Now I get the phone call about the denial Thursday, the weekend before we start classes. So I forget the date, 27th maybe?
Something along those lines, yeah.
Something like that. We're starting on the 30th. I said, I'm not responding to anything unless you write it down. So I get an email Friday morning. Again, we're starting classes Monday. And they say at that time, first time this is introduced, oh, we got something else we might be able to do for you. We're going to offer you two online classes. You'll have to use the rest of your sick leave, but that'll get you to three quarters pay. And these online classes we're offering you have not been in the catalog. They're for high demand classes. I still don't really know what that means. The courses are not identified.
Yeah, they didn't tell you, like, these courses, like, intro to psychology. They didn't, nothing, just like.
No, I have no information on that. I'm supposed to be doing this come Monday. These are courses that I don't know what the topic is. No student has ever heard of the class.
I don't mean to be laughing, but this is just like, I mean, this is unbelievable.
And it was offered to me without consultation, as far as I can tell. It was offered to me without consultation with the department. So the department, when they're informed of this, say, what? high demand courses are we talking about? I said, I don't know. But that's what I'm told.
Wow.
Now, there's other rumors that have since been relayed to me about what format the class might be, but I wasn't told that. All I'm told is two online courses for high demand.
It's like, we've got this carrot for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually don't refer to it as a carrot. I refer to it as 30 pieces of silver.
Yeah. There we go. Well, there you go. There you go. And we should also add into this, too, as well. As you recall, we covered this at Raging Chicken. I talked about this in the show last week, too, as well. There was a case a few years back where you had an adjunct faculty member who was basically told by their doctor that, look, you need this surgery. It's an emergency surgery. I don't know the details of that, but it's just emergency surgery, or you're going to die, right? I suspect it had to do with a heart surgery, or but I don't know that for sure. And so that faculty member said, oh, well, what are you going to do here? And the, you know, the university basically said, well, you don't have enough sick leave, right, to do it. So we're just going to have to get rid of it, right? Which would mean losing health insurance at a time when they need to go to life-saving surgery. Right. And at that point, the Amanda Morris was our faculty union president. And basically she came forward, she said, well, look, well, let's look for solutions here. Right. And went to faculty and said, would you be willing to donate your sick days? And faculty are overwhelmingly like, absolutely. Right. Matter of fact, the department had already said, look, we have agreed as a department to cover their classes ahead of time. And we will donate sick leave too as well to make sure that they're going to be well. The university refused to allow us to have a local agreement that would allow us to donate sick leave, right? And they refused to allow for that accommodation. And so therefore, they cut that person off. And then Amanda, once again, went forward and raised, like got us in to raise money to cover that person's COBRA costs so they could have that surgery. And like President Hawkinson and the university was like, oh, we feel really bad for this. We encourage people to, I was like, are you freaking kidding me? Yeah. And so here we are again, which I know this question has come up on the faculty listserv already. It's like people just stepping forward saying, look, can we donate sick time? Can we make sure that, you know, that Steve and as you've consistently say to faculty on the listserv and everyone who will listen, it's not just you, right? Mm-hmm. Would you be willing to come for and like, yes, tell us what we need to do. How do we do this? And we're met also with, nope, sorry.
Yep, can't do it. There's a sick leave bank that some people can access, I'm not allowed to.
Right.
Because I've had, after my time is used up, I've used the 90 days. If I could have pushed the surgery another semester, my recovery would have crossed into a new calendar year, which then would have made me eligible.
See, it's your fault, but Steve. I couldn't. You should have just pushed the surgery. Come on.
I think the term is what? Grit and fortitude has been used?
Grit and fortitude. There you go.
I should have more grit and fortitude. Jesus, I could have made Christ. That heart pump better.
That's right. Why don't you get back in that coal mine and breathe in that coal dust for a few more lines? Have the grit and fortitude, and maybe you won't get that black lung on the way out. The same freaking nonsense.
Yes. So I have until Monday at 4:30 to reply. Mm-hmm. Monday, 4:30, when classes have already begun. So I did not either accept or reject the offer. What I did instead was to list a series of questions about the courses. What are they? Who decides what they are? How are students going to be notified about the availability of the course? What are the minimum enrollments that might be in place? Mm-hmm. What if I don't make minimum enrollments? Are you going to pull them out? Because after all, students have already started classes.
Are they even going to be Kutztown University students, for that matter?
Yes. Yeah, I didn't phrase one that good. There's nothing other than it's going to be an online high-demand course. That's all I know at that point. And I said, I can't accept either. I don't know. There's not enough detail. I asked a bunch of questions. My reply was, we've got your response. In this case, all you can do is use your sick pay and you'll be unpaid after that. That's it. And that's where I stand. That's what will happen this semester. I will not be teaching at any level. I will use up my 15 sick day pays and 2 personal leave days. And I will be unpaid the rest of the semester.
And my guess is that they're going to force other faculty members of the department to do an overload to teach those classes as opposed to make accommodations or do an emergency hire at the last minute.
They have what is happening is there are faculty taking on new preparations and overloads to cover my courses, and we are given approval to have some additional temporary part-time faculty hired to cover the courses that need to be shuffled around so that they can cover my class. And one other faculty member, I'm not naming this member, who was also denied ADA coverage for a medical condition, and what they decided to do was to use their sick time. They had the time to use to take the semester and use sick time. And so their courses had to be covered as well. Another faculty member in our department left unexpectedly. Her courses have to be covered. Our chair goes on sabbatical, and we now have an interim chair. His courses have to be covered. This is a huge strain. We had another faculty member retire. From the spring of 2021 to the fall of 2021, we lost 5 faculty members because of ADA denials, sabbaticals, leaving the university, and retirement. And all those courses we're trying to cover. The remaining faculty and some temporary faculties are trying to cover. I can't cover all of them, but I'd be more than happy to cover mine and maybe somebody else's if I could get approved remotely.
So,
but I can't.
Now this is, now people who listen to the show and been around long enough with Raging Chicken know my line on this, but I've said this 1,001. When you have an issue that you kind of need to address, whether it's kind of enrollment or whether it's a crisis or something like this, right? The only tool in the toolbox is not public relations, right? Mm-hmm. And what has been? I don't even have the words for it, but what has been? I'll be mild about it. What has been infuriatingly frustrating is to watch them invest all this money in kind of a rebranding campaign, of which one of the center pieces of that new mission and goals of the university is to be a caring community. And we have a president of the university, and we have all this material about the university about just shouting from the rooftops about Kutztown University being a caring community. And I don't know how you make that phrase more hollow than by doing what they're doing to you, other faculty members, than what they're doing. This is just cruelty with a smiley face, in my view.
I agree. Now, I had that other period of poor health where I had to fight through depression to adapt. And I did. But it was not easy, and I was not easy to deal with at that time. But I was positive. I was upbeat going into this transplant surgery. I stayed upbeat. I worked as hard as I could. I did everything they asked. If they said, we got to get you out of bed, you got to walk, and I'm in pain, I got up because that's what I had to do. I did everything. I did not turn down anything, no matter how painful it was. But I was still upbeat. I had a goal. I'm coming back.
Yeah.
Now it's turned to anger about the reaction. But I will say this for people who are listening, other faculty members, staff members, students, there are other faculty right now who are struggling with depression because of some of these caring administrators. Okay, I'm not. I'm pissed off. I'm angry. I'm going public because I don't give a shit what happens to me.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. But I at this point, do what you want. I've been through stuff. I can tolerate it. But there are others. This is the first time they're seeing this and being applied to them.
Right.
And they're struggling. We have to reach out. I mean, they're not willing yet or unable for varying reasons to identify themselves. But look around the campus, look at your colleagues, see who, if you have a concern, approach that person. Don't let them just say they're feeling good. sit down and really talk to them. There are people who need support. If anybody out there hears this and wants to talk about support, contact me. I got my Kutztown email. I've got private email. I've got phone. I'm willing to share. I'm willing to talk to anybody.
And I'll put that just this. And just for that, we'll put that contact information as well too in the show notes too as well. So people are listening to this and they're looking to get in touch. I appreciate the offer, and I'm sure other people will too as well. So that they can do that. To reach out.
Yeah, because it is not just me. I'll get by. I don't know if I'll ever be back.
Right.
If this pandemic continues as it is. Come spring semester, what will happen? Do I have my courses listed as face-to-face and go through this again if I'm not allowed back? Do I take a chance and list them as I'm going to remotely offer them when Kutztown has clearly said we don't want to do that? There's apparently a plan they're working on that might be some version of a mix.
It's all bullshit.
I'm not involved in those discussions, but I'm partly involved in that. I get to talk indirectly. I get to talk to people who are involved in that. I don't know what the final details will be, but I may be back in the same boat come spring.
Well, and look, I mean, we have, you know, this is what was a faculty that are organizing right now around the kind of COVID mitigation stuff that we were we had a meeting last night. We were talking about kind of like, how can we both kind of highlight your story and how can we make sure that, you know, to push back the university here? Because look, you know, there's one thing if that you could be secure. In your circumstance, no. You make the accommodation, period, right? Mm-hmm. But watching the university doing the absolute minimal required by law, right, in terms of mitigation strategies for COVID-19 on campus. It's like, I mean, you know as well as I do, we're walking in classes, we're playing mask police with our freaking students. Right. I'm walking through buildings and say as soon as a student gets out of the classroom, pulling it down, walking around in hallways and sitting around out there and some adults on campus, whoever they are. I mean, people I don't know, but watching them kind of also doing the same thing. People don't know. They got to freaking, you know, put their junk under their mask. That includes their nose. Right.
Yes.
And I'm looking at this. So if you're telling me this is what the situation actually looks like. Right. They can't even make good on their own minimalist responses. So you're talking about risk being spread around. I mean, you've heard we had a meeting last night talking about people are, you know, like I have a daughter, which I've talked about on the show. That she's like, you know, she's not eligible for the vaccine yet because she's not 12. Right. And so I live in a school district where you have freaking nut jobs running the school board that are also kind of mask optional over here. Mm-hmm. Right. And other faculty members are in similar situations. And then you've got students even who are, you know, living with kind of parents or grandparents and things like this could be at risk too as well. And so to see that, like, the petri dish that is Kutztown University, right, on top of what's going on, like to ask you to head back in there is like. That is like, you know, I mean, look, this is why, like, you know, I think I've mentioned this before on the show. One of the things that there's some faculty members and here parents in the Penn Ridge School District where I'm at right now are looking at this aspect of state created danger, which we're looking at kind of what are our legal options for do this, because it seems like nobody wants to push this, which is why I think it's so critical that, you know, that your story is kind of starting to get out there, because I think people are starting to understand, like, the callousness by which kind of we're moving forward and the danger we're putting everybody in.
And that's what I hoped when I first started putting this out. I didn't ask anybody if I was allowed to do this. I just said, it can't be happening just to me. And somebody has to say this is happening. And at that point, given how I was being responded to, what the hell, I'll do it. I don't care. At this point, I mean, yeah, do I care? Sure. You know, it's not, I don't want to retire. I don't want to leave if I don't have to, but I'm fortunate enough to be in a position where I could.
Right.
I want to come back. I'm doing everything I can to get back, but I could tolerate it. I could find a way, but there are others newer in careers, untenured, adjunct, staff members, students, struggling to make their way through, they're not in the position perhaps to be public. But going public only works
right
if people support this.
Right.
I can say everything I want. But if there isn't a broader support, Kusum will be allowed to keep doing what they're doing. And it's wrong. It's, I think they'll be shown wrong illegally, mm-hmm. but it's immoral. It's yes. abhorrent
yes.
what they're doing.
Yes.
And that.
So let me ask you this. I mean, I know that there's people at this point too, that are looking for kind of things that they can do. And one of the things that I will include in the show notes for here too, as well, there was a list of items that, of actions from kind of writing letters to, kind of writing letters to the university's president, writing letters to the chancellor of the system and all this. But, you know, if you're people are looking for what can they do at this point, kind of what are some of the things you think that, that would be useful for people to do now?
Well, exactly what you've said, but share the story. If outside of class time, students don't, you can't use class time and you should not be using your class time to do this. But if you're outside of class time, official hours, students are wondering about the campus environment, you can share these stories. You can tell friends. If you happen to know somebody who's in the associated with the press, you can tell them. You can reach out to politicians at varying levels. Look at the politicians in your district where you live. Look at the politicians in Kutztown University's district and reach out to them. There are people more skilled at this than me. This is my first time ever going this public. I've always supported the union. I've showed up for union events. When we were forced into a strike, I showed up. To the degree I could. I have to go to a higher degree of action.
Yes.
And I don't think I'm the only one who needs to step up. Individuals like yourself, we can name many others.
Yep.
I mean, Amy and Amanda and Dan and Mike, you know, all and others that I maybe aren't naming right now, have always been much more active and assertive than I had been. I can't let that go anymore. I have to be one of the people being more assertive. But I'm not the only one who has to.
Right.
There are others who have to be more assertive. Those individuals who've been through this know other ways to share. And I know the faculty are talking about gathering a bunch of ideas and sharing them with people. I'm sure some great ideas will come out of this. But little things even. I am really happy people are back in person. And I really hope they survive this.
Yeah.
And I understand student excitement to come back. My daughter's excited. She goes to a college where they are requiring people to talk about their vaccination status. They have a 93% vaccination rate of students and staff. If you're unvaccinated, even if you have a reason, you have to submit to regular testing.
Right.
She is thrilled to go back.
Well, and let's be clear, what Steve just said there too is Kutztown University does not have contact tracing in place. They do not even have reporting of your vaccination status, right? I mean,
yes.
put the requirement of the vaccinations. I think everyone should be required to be vaccinated to come back, right? Or have a thing, or submit a very minimal submit to kind of like randomized consistent testing throughout
yes.
there to keep everybody safe,
yes.
right? I mean, there's a bunch of things to get, but like I said, the university is doing the absolute minimal, which is basically saying, wear a mask. That's it.
Well, yeah, and let's take it even further. They started the semester before students arrived, saying, no, we're going to require masks.
Right, exactly.
They only changed that as the rate. Yes, with pressure. My daughter has asked me, if she was attending Kutztown University, would I have allowed her to go back? And I said, not a chance in hell would I have.
Yep.
Then she asked, would I allow her to go back to her college? And I said, yes.
Yep.
They are 93% vaccinated. They are testing people, not just the unvaccinated. They are randomly selecting people who are vaccinated and testing.
Exactly.
They're doing contact tracing, and they are still requiring masks indoors on campus. Yes, I would let her go back. She's vaccinated. She is older than 12. She's vaccinated. I insisted everybody got vaccinated. There was no hesitancy in my family on this. I've gotten vaccinated as soon as I was cleared to.
Yep.
And I've now since gotten the third shot because I'm immunocompromised and I'm approved for a third shot. And if I may, one other note.
Please.
I got this third shot because research studies have shown that solid organ transplant patients who get this vaccine, if they get, let's say, the two shot or the one shot Johnson & Johnson, up to half of them show no immune system response to the vaccine after two or the one dose of Johnson & Johnson. After the third shot, it's still reported that up to a third of those solid organ transplant patients show no apparent benefit from the vaccines. So I got a third shot. There's still roughly a 33% chance that I'm not protected from the virus.
Right.
Even if I could come back, I'd be masking, washing hands, but I would not have been allowed to require students to wear a mask. I could have asked them, but if they chose not to, I couldn't require it in my classroom. Never minding the fact that who knows what happened in that classroom before I entered it.
Exactly.
I can't. I want to come back, but I'm not going to die to do it if I can avoid that.
Well, I hear you, man. Well, and listen, Steve, you know, this is one thing for everybody to know out there is that this is not going to be the last time I don't think we're going to hear from Steve.
No.
And that we here at Raging Chicken are going to do everything that we possibly can to kind of keep the spotlight on this and keep the pressure going. I'm going to have a list in addition to some of the action items that are coming out from the faculty members about where you can write, who you can contact and say, and you do not need to be a member of the Kutztown University community in order to do this, because this is like, I mean, at the baseline, like human response to like the way that we should be treating each other in the world, this cannot stand.
No.
This cannot stand. And I want to use a little quote here that Steve kind of closed out one of his emails with to bring us to the kind of close of today's show before we think about going forward. And this is at the end of an email, Steve said, "For now, I leave you with this lyric from Pink. This used to be a fun house, but now it's full of evil clowns." And that's where it seems where we're at. Crazy. Steve, look, I know, I mean, you've been busy and you had to deal with a lot. I appreciate you taking as much time as you have today, really to kind of be here. And like I said before the show, and I'll say now publicly so everybody knows, is that we will do everything we can to kind of help support this and put a spotlight on it. I'm here with you, brother. I'm here with you with the fight.
And I do appreciate that. And I will be trying to contact everybody who sent me messages. I'm working on getting back to everybody. But if I miss somebody accidentally, inadvertently, I can't tell you how much I appreciate the support I've been receiving.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. You just heard the story of Steve Oros today. And like I said, we'll be putting action items there before. I just cannot believe that we are in a situation in which people are being treated like this at a public university right here in Pennsylvania. And if people are not outraged and moved to action, I don't know what else to tell you. But I know there's a lot of people out there that are not going to let this stand. We need to let this stand and make sure that we kind of support Steve, but every other worker out there that is being forced to deal with the same thing. So this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. Thank you for tuning in. And we'll be back with that special live show kind of later on tonight. And we're going to dig in to your thoughts and your responses. We'll talk to you soon. We're headed out, maybe, if my my music, there you go. Great moment. Here you go. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder. We're out of here. Got to have a little techno flaw at the end, don't we? Yes, we do indeed. All right. Take care, Steve, man. Be in touch.
Thank you.
See ya.